You're going to spend a merry 1 hour and 15 minutes, probably more, since I tend to speak a lot, talking about the Windows Identity Foundation and its use in Windows Azure. How many of you ever worked with Windows Azure? One, two. Wow. How many of you ever heard of Windows Azure? Ah, our marketing is powerful. You all heard of it. Okay. So, how are we going to do this thing? I'm going to take the canonical example, which by now you know what it is the sign-in in the passive case, like it's the vast majority of cases, that's what you want to do, you want to sign in on a website, and I'm going to dissect it, raising some specific details which we normally overlook. Like that those are such low-level details that we normally don't care about, and it turns out that when you move in the cloud, those details do matter. And then, after that, we'll do basically one collection of tricks. That's to say that we'll take the classic browser-based single sign-on and WCF services, and we'll just look at those scenarios and what we need to do for making those scenarios work well in the cloud. If we'll have time, and here that's your clue to laugh, we may even talk about custom STSs in the cloud, but we won't. So, I spent like 1 day and a half saying that this claims-based identity thing works both on-premise and in the cloud with no modifications. And now, instead, I'm about to deliver 1 hour session about how to make scenarios we already studied work in the cloud. I'm sure that some of you will see some contradiction about that. Well, there is no contradiction. How many of you are able to play any game with cards? Wow. Really? Anything that has to do with cards. Perfect. Okay, so now imagine that you have to explain to a friend of yours how to play that game and how to be good at that game, like strategies and stuff like that. I am sure that you'd think about rules, about number of cards, how like strategies, like watch out for that thing rather than that other, but you'd never worry about things like, okay, if you're playing indoor, you can use a table, but if you're playing on the beach, make sure that you put a big stone on the deck, otherwise the wind will scatter your cards everywhere. Am I right? You would not normally think of those details. Well, claims-based identity on-premise and in the cloud is kind of the same. All the rules, all the architectural tricks that we learned so far are absolutely the same, regardless of where your application lives. There is no difference whatsoever. The difference is that in the cloud, the wind may scatter your cards. That's to say that in the cloud, unless you're doing co-location and just using the term cloud, let's say just virtual machines, typically there are restrictions or hypotheses on your environment, like literally on the infrastructure on which you are running, which may force you to perform some tricks. Or simply, the scope is bigger. For example, you are in a load-balanced environment. And so there are details that are no longer details, are things that you need to address. But this is completely independent from the concept of claims-based identity and how you break problems down, and even how you write the code. So no contradiction. Yes. That's one place where I went in vacation. So now that's your clue for falling asleep, classic slide of a vacation. Well, it's always hard when you do a deck that you have to redistribute to find an image and knowing that you can redistribute that image, because every time different rights, everybody is different. So this time I'm kindly donating to Microsoft this image, And so that, as the owner of a copyright, I actually give it. So here we, of course, I'm trying to represent the on-premise world and the cloud world. So let's actually spend some time thinking about the on-premise world. So here, traditional technology. Here we have our usual scenario. Relying party, identity provider. Identity provider can be whatever. For making the identity provider, the relying party behave the way that we behaved, we need all the things that we described, but we also need some infrastructure, specifically like the most humble of the features, the file system. Of course, we can access the file system, right? All the considerations that we made about let's use the config file so that we don't have to change the app, well, that kind of implies that we can go on the web config and change values. And well, that happens only if you have some control of this guy. Obvious, right? Well, not so much. Code, extra code. Our little component which intercepts calls, our Windows Identity Foundation HTTP modules, live in one DLL which is not part of a global address, assembly cache. It's something that we install. As a result, that means that we have the power to perform installations, which is the case when we own the system, is not always the case when we host the stuff outside, right? And then, if we want this guy to actually listen, we need an infrastructure which actually listens to my messages, dispatches the message to the right class, instantiates it, recycles it, reserves ports, all the usual stuff. So basically, that means that we need IIS and ASP.NET. Also, we want some degree of control over the endpoint that we are exposing. So sometimes we'll have SVC services, but if we want to be really REST friendly, we want to hide the implementation. So maybe we will want URL rewriter modules, like all these kind of things, which again are trivial in the case in which I own the thing, but less trivial in the case in which I actually don't have that. And then finally, if I want to do things like HTTPS or play with cryptography, I do need things like certificate store, because I need to keep my keys somewhere. So all those things are so obvious that I didn't waste time speaking about those in those 2 days. Well, guess what? When you ascend to the cloud, that's no longer the case. Let's say that before I had my machine, my data center, whatever I was using. Here in the cloud, actually, I don't know what I have. I am pretty sure that I don't have the same that I had before. And without machine, all this stuff kind of crumbles. And as a result, your application, like Will Coyote, goes down as well after some time. Now, we said that we don't have a machine on the cloud, but what do we have? Let's spend a few moments talking about Windows Azure. How many of you used something in the cloud which is not Windows Azure? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And if I wait some more, the seventh, where is the seventh? So here, as you know, and as I said it myself, cloud is like the new darling of marketing departments. So everybody wants to slap the label cloud to whatever they are doing. The reality is that there is a difference between simply something which is not on your premises and something that is, in fact, like representing a new trend, like a new way of doing things. The idea behind Windows Azure, one of the many ideas behind Windows Azure, is when you are dealing with a distributed system, you no longer can settle with an operating system which is made for one single machine and just have features for like having machines to communicate to each other. You need an operating system which exposes those resources, like the resources of clusters of machines, as a single unit. That's to say that This is kind of like taking your machine and thinking of a scheduler of your processor. When you write software for and you target one modern operating system, you don't worry about how the scheduler of a processor will take care of multitasking. Multitasking is a feature of an operating system. It will just happen. Like, you don't have to be an expert in processing synchronization or scheduling algorithm, all this stuff. You can blissfully ignore all that because the operating system protects you from that. So how is it that when you go somewhere else, like in the clusters, instead you don't have that? Like, if you want, for example, state, which is available everywhere, you need to plan for that. Like, you need to put databases in a certain way. You have to make sure that you synchronize that in a certain way. If you wanted to have software which scales out, like one application that I put somewhere, and if I want more power, I just add another machine, and my application capability scales, well, that doesn't happen on its own. You have to plan for that. You need to be an expert in distributed systems. Well, it shouldn't be that way. That's to say that if the resource that I'm using is the data center, I should need an operating system which offers those resources as a whole. That's one of the ideas behind Windows Azure. Like, Windows Azure tries to give you capabilities rather than just a bunch of machines, so that you can actually use those capabilities, tap on those capabilities, without worrying about the underlying infrastructure. That means, of course, that you also have some restrictions. That's to say that if I want to enable you to develop software that will scale just by turning a knob, that means that I have to try to prevent you from doing things that would block that behavior. And so we'll see that there are various like rails that the infrastructure gives you, and that on those rails that we will have to work out our strategy. Just blabbering, or did you follow me? I see a lot of nodding. Perfect. Also, thumbs up. Thank you. So, in practice, Windows Azure, one of the capabilities it offers is compute. So how do we do that? We offer you an virtualized, but don't get it in the wrong way, not virtual machine, a virtualized standard .NET 3.5 environment. In other words, if you write your application targeting that version of a framework, we will run it on your behalf. Like, in this kind of virtual environment, you don't have to think about a physical machine. We can do websites, we can do WCF, we can do even work roles, just like processing. We can make pinvoke to native code, and the physical machine, which could actually be a virtual machine, but anyway, the machine in the sense that we are used to think of, like a machine with a start button, with config, with registry, with file system, is just not there. It's there, of course, because it's not the Holy Ghost that runs this stuff, but for you, it's not there. Like, this stuff is inaccessible. So that prevents you from doing weird things. Then we have storage. That's a space which is independent of from any instance that you can use and be assured that this stuff will be replicated, will be available, will for any instance or this thing will always be there. And you have it in two flavors. Table, which is just structured storage but not relational, and blob, which is just an area in which you shove binaries without shape. Again, non-transactional. Like, if you want relational stuff in the cloud, we have it. It's in SQL Azure, but I will not touch on that. And then, of course, you need ways of managing that. And besides having a portal, we have APIs, REST APIs, which allow you to do things like starting those things, which we call roles, no relation with the user roles. Or, for example, add stuff to your storage, manage certificates, all those kind of things. So that's, in a nutshell, what you get in Windows Azure. And in fact, one thing that I absolutely, absolutely love of our platform is you can play with that even if you are on a plane that does not offer Wi-Fi. A few years ago, I would have just said, if you are on a plane. Now I have to add that it doesn't have Wi-Fi. Thanks to the fact that we have a complete simulation environment. So, of course, the environment that we have in the cloud, which we call Fabric, is pretty much like the operating system, like the thing that makes all these cloud things happen, the stuff that manage instances, manage access from those instances to your storage, and similar. So there is this nice simulation environment which literally live on your machine, and you can use for running things like you would be running it in the cloud. So you can start multiple instances, you can test the load balancing, which happens automatically thanks to the system. So that's a really, really, really powerful system. So powerful that all the demos that I'm going to do will be on that. I will not touch the cloud. Also because when you touch the cloud, you pay. Now, well, I could take the hit, but that's just for making the point that this stuff works. One interesting feature of the system is that it is a multi-staged environment. Let's say that you have the stage in which you develop things on your machine. And then you say, OK, more or less, we are fine, so let's move to staging. There is one environment in which you can do staging of your application. And finally, when you are satisfied, you can move it in production. So it is actually multi-area, and that's pretty handy. So now that we have seen that there is actually something that can be salvaged, let's see what we can retrieve. So it's not that we have nothing. We have a role, what we said before, the area which is supposed to be executed. Thank you for being here. I did that exactly for that. At least you did it. Thank you. So this is the area that we use for executing our application. So how do we get our application to be here? Be executed in the role. A big yellow envelope. Now, the big yellow envelope represents what we call a package. Like, there is a specific format, which, big secret, it's a zip file renominated, very old trick in distributed systems, which contains your application. Your application and everything that pertains to the application in itself. So for example, here, if you want to use Windows Identity Foundation, you'll have to add the DLL in itself, because otherwise, you will not have it in this environment. Also, the web config of your application is in here. So if you want to change something, you cannot change it here. The only way is redeploying another package. So that's you can start to see what it means, all the various resources that I put in here, and saying here we don't have the same possibilities. Yes, sir. Yes, the runtime is different. Sorry. The question is, do you have different DLLs depending on the operating system? Yes, they are different.
So while deploying in the cloud, I will have to know which DLL I have to pick.
Yes, but then you will know which DLL you have to pick, but luckily it's not a hard choice. Like, you know the characteristic of a virtualized environment, so you'd deliver the right one. Like, you know it a priori, so you can pick the right one. Another question? Ah, perfect. Okay, here you have another thing which you use in your deployment, which is something which describes your deployment. So it describes your package, describes things like how many instances you want, and stuff like that. That is something that you can change after the upload. So what else do we have? Here you have your storage, which you can use for putting data, and as you can see, it lives outside of this specific part, so it can be shared across various instances or other instances. And typically, if you want to make changes to this application, we are back to the if-def. Let's say that we can have code which looks at one table, and choose different paths. Like, for example, you may have multiple configuration sections, and just pick the right one according to the environment where you are running. And here, you could have one table with one line that says which environment are you running on. At that point, you just switch. So, pretty straightforward. What else do we have? Ah, yes. Here, of course, I can have multiple instances, and what we get is, for free, a load balancer. A load balancer, which stays there and is completely transparent, will take care of basically presenting to the world one single URL, but take care of that. One interesting thing is that here you have, of course, like node port numbers, because that's how the load balancer works. Normally, all those are hidden, but when you do certain operations with WCF, those port numbers will actually come out, so that when from outside you do an SVC util on one service which is hosted, let's say here, you may end up seeing in the address this number, which means, of course, that when you try to call, that won't work, because you are outside of a load balancer. So there are steps that we need to do for ensuring that that doesn't happen. Another interesting part, the endpoint that you have in here, is not entirely under your control. When you are running on a dev fabric, the address is always 127.0.0.1 and some port. Like any application you are using, that will be the address. There is no way around it. When you move the application to staging, the address will be a GUID, which you don't know until the deployment took place, .cloudapp.net. Like it just gets assigned automatically on the fly. So that means that if you have stuff in the config which is tied to your address, well, you kind of have a hard time. If you remember what we said about the apply to the audience restriction for the WIF situation, that one is in theory the name of the application, but WIF often use it also as an address. At that point, if you are doing that, then it's kind of a problem, because if you send it to the STS request in which there is the address that you have in here, which is the address without the GUID, and the STS actually makes the post to that address, but you are instead listening to something that starts with a GUID, you won't get the result. On the other hand, if you solve this problem and you send something which contains a GUID, which you just generated, the STS may not recognize it, saying, who are you? You are not one configured running part. So again, this is something that we have to think about. As you note, those are like all details. Like, it's not that the idea of using an STS or using that identity provider is wrong. Absolutely not. It's simply that those are features of this specific arrangement. Ah, yeah, and of course, for the certificates, here, that's a machine for which I don't have access to low level, so I cannot install the certificates that I need. So there is a mechanism in which basically the certificates all live outside. I save certificates in here. In this config, I say which certs I need. And at activation time, the system will automatically deploy certificates in here. So again, interesting complications. The question is, does it also support the chain certificate stuff? I'm not sure what you mean. But anyway, you cannot change the roots of the certificates in Windows Azure. So you cannot put an arbitrary root. You'll have to use the certificates that are from that number of CAs that is already in place. So like, if you have your own CA, or if you are doing self-signed, you're out of luck. Okay, now that more or less you have a feeling of what we have to work with, let's actually take some detail. So here we have our good friend, browser-based Sanyon. So here we know exactly where the drill. Try to get in here, redirected, get token, send token, drop cookie, and we are done. Okay, so how does that change once we introduce the location? So now, when I land in here, as we said, the address where I'm going may change. So that means that once I come back here and I ask for a token, I have two problems to solve. One, I need to give the correct return address, which may not be the case if I'm using the applies to. Two, I need to make sure that the identity provider understands what should be, like the fact that this relying party is still my relying party, even if it now lives at a different address. And it's not over, because in this case, we have just one, but imagine that you have two of those. And imagine that I create my session with these, like I get my cookie, but then the next request goes to the second one. Let's see if somebody can guess what could be the problem with that. I'm sorry? Well, that may be a consequence. But let's say that here the main problem is, by default, Windows Identity Foundation encrypts your cookie using DPAPI. How many of you know what is DPAPI? A precious few. Actually, one. DPAPI is a set of APIs that are used for doing a crypto on a specific machine. And in this case, you would encrypt and sign the token using the machine key. Machine key, which could happily be different from this one. So I create the cookie. Actually, let me make a little picture. Like here, I have this key, and here I have this key. If I create this cookie and I encrypt it with my key, and then I send it, of course, square key, round key, they don't work. So here, I would actually or throw or have to go and get a cookie for me as well, which of course would probably override the one here, and so on and so forth. So we need to do something for solving that situation as well. So let's get to it. Let's take a quick look at the fact that this stuff does work. And since I did everything on 2010, now I will actually show you a bit on the fact that all this works also on Visual Studio 2008, just in case you guys don't want to jump on a new ship very soon. As it loads, do you guys have any questions so far? Go ahead. So the question is, how do I handle certificates for multiple deployment stages? Well, that's completely up to you, like you would be doing it normally. Like you have full control about which certificates you upload, and you have full control about how do you tie that certificate to that specific role instance. So there is nothing out of the box that will give you like a view of the certificates in staging and another view of certificates in production. Like if you can make that happen, but you have to do it yourself.
You know, what I mean to say is SPS is we want to use the same SPS which is on premises, and we want to have multiple deployments.
Not necessarily. So, the doubt is if every deployment should have a different certificate. Not necessarily. Let's say that when you get the GUID, well, you'll get the red bar that says, hey, the certificate doesn't match the URL, but whatever. Otherwise, you'd go crazy. And the same goes for WCF. You just like put the various settings which turn off the voice checks, and you turn them on back once you get in production. Otherwise, you go crazy. Okay, what do we have in here? Here we have three projects. There is this new kind, which is kind of bluish, which is a project, like a template, that comes with the tools for Windows Azure. That's the kind of project that you can use for the simulation environment locally. It's really, really nice. And here it has one role, which looks suspiciously similar to this project. It has exactly the same name. So you may have guessed how it works. This is simply like a representation of this project. But in the end, when you develop, this is just another project. So for you, there is no difference. It's simply that you are configuring that to be instantiated in the cloud. And by the way, this is like the end result of one of the labs in Windows Azure. So if you go for the labs on Windows Azure, you'll obtain these. And here, as you can see, it open. That is just a classic website. The only difference is this little web role CS, which is simply something that allow me to sign in certain events in the life cycle of a cloud project. But just it. Everything else is the same. And here, we have our usual STS, which, as you can see, if I stop zooming around, lives on localhost. So in this specific example, I'm showing you how you can reuse in the cloud identities that live on-premise, because this guy runs on localhost, so not that hard. And if I double-click on this guy, then you'll see a number of options that I can use in this context. Like, for example, the number of instances, all these kind of considerations. Those are various options which end up written in that little config that goes together with my package. And I can use it for deriving how many instances I want, my estimate of how much space I need for running. Yeah, well, this one is a debug detail, but other things may include which certificates I want, which endpoints I'm using. In this case, I just want HTTPS, and I want this certificate. Like all these kind of details. Note that here I'm saying which certificate I want, but this does not have the effect of uploading the certificate in the cloud. Like, this will be used as a debug locally, this information, not necessarily the same certificate. But when I want the certificate to show up in the cloud, I need my admin to do it on my behalf. Like, when I upload a package, inside of a package, there is no certificate. So let's just give it a spin. If now I hit F5, now, let me point your attention to what's happening in here. And of course, the tooltip in the wrong place. Ah, come on. Here, the system is launching my development, my simulation of a cloud environment. And basically, it's starting the storage. It started already the fabric. And then after that, it will create the package out of my application, and then deploy it in this virtual environment. So it's doing exactly what I'd be doing with the cloud. In fact, in my methods, I also have a publish method, which instead of building, it actually packages this stuff and opens the portal on the right place where I can do the deployment. Yep. Okay, and I think, yes, it's starting, waiting for all instances to start. And in fact, I can even show you the environment in itself. It's this little guy here. Show development fabric. It's all good. So, oop, okay, blocked it. This is the address of your application, any application, when run in Windows Azure app, the Dev Fabric. And as you can see, is this address, and then 444, because 443 is busy. I have IIS on this machine. So it will automatically assign a different port. I'm using that anyway, because when I actually deploy in the cloud, I do want 443. And if I let it go, as promised, now we are authenticating on the local machine. So you can imagine your local ADFS providing this functionality. And so if... I'm sorry. That's okay, because that's IIS. So the question was, how come the STS port didn't, the STS URL didn't have a port? That's IIS. The port is only for the Dev Fabric. And in fact, here, we ended up, again, now we are in the fabric. So whoever rendered this page is not IIS, but is that little thingy. And as we can see, we got claims WF worked as advertised. And here you can see the UI of our simulation environment. Let me zoom in it. This is actually our little simulation. This is all our role. We have just one, but we can have as many as we want. In fact, once we get to WCF, we'll have at least two, so we can see the session. Okay, so that's the project. Now let's look in more details at the issues that we have to solve, and then we'll go back and forth with the code and see how we solve them. Wow. I have to do this at TechEd next week. I don't know how people who didn't have the benefit of one entire day of seeing those details are going to take it. I'll do my best. So, as we said, application package is just a big package which contains my project and all the things I need. Configuration settings travel in this different file, which roles, which certificates I want, and similar. You need to make sure that you put it in the package. If it's not in the package and you want it, you have to redeploy. So think about it. Well, redeploying is not exactly like a disaster. But if you are already in production, then, well, you have to be careful. And in fact, for bringing WF up in your system, the easy trick is just going into the reference, flip the copy local to true so that you get the DLL, and then everything will work. As I mentioned, if you want to do some behavior which is parametric, you can use the storage and have simply your app which is dynamic on that respect. As we said, apply to, we tended to consider to be the same, but in Windows Azure, this is kind of problematic because your app will be your app, cloudapp.net, only in production. Before that, GUID, we discovered at the last moment, and the Dev Fabric. And of course, there is also the little detail that we said of the load balancer, which sometimes pulls out. So how do we solve that? On the relying party, one thing we can do is, if you remember, the service element had different names. Like I can have different sections with different names. So here we could have service name production, service name staging, and I can hook up the event like a service configuration loaded, something like that. And there, actually switch between sections. So at that point, I can make it parametric. Then, wreply. Wreply is like WHR, WA, WTRealm, and so on, one variable which WS Federation recognize. That's the variable that you can use for telling the STS where to send back your the answer, the response, the W result. And it's not hard to add it in the system. Can anybody guess in which handler I would put the injection of a wreply? We have seen one handler. The redirecting to identity provider. Just before we are sending stuff to the identity provider, we can grab the message, inject the wreply, and then let it go. And then it will carry that information. We have to get the address, our own address, we are the application which is running, from these, from the headers of a request. Why? Because of the load balancer. If I take the usual variables that I have in ASP.NET, it would tell me the physical address, which is the one with a port, which we don't want. So the only way of making sure that the address that we use is an address which is addressable from outside is to actually use the one that they used in the first place. So the one which is in the request. So we just use that. It's not too pretty, but it works. On the STS side, if you are ADFS, well, ADFS does not process wreply. It has a good reason for doing so, because as you can imagine, wreply has an enormous potential for attack. Because if I can just attach something at some point that says a different address, then I can like capture the token. If the token is not encrypted, if I manage to capture it before you use it, I can actually use it for starting a session. And the duplication check will not help. So it is dangerous. Like you need to make steps for protecting you. If you are ADFS, however, you cannot use it. So this solution doesn't work. If you're writing your own STS, handling this is not hard. It's just one if I'll show you in a minute. If you are ADFS, well, guess what? Every single deployment for you is another STS, another relying party. So in Dev Fabric, in staging, and whatever instance of staging, and in production, you need every time to add one entry in the ADFS saying this is a recognized relying party. Not very agile, but secure. So let's take a quick look at the code. First, to the web role. Here you can see our good friend, the global ASAX. And here, I didn't lie to you, redirecting to identity provider. That's exactly what we use. So here, we retrieve a URL, we create our wreply, we pull out from this guy the address that was used, we assign it to sign in request message what we just got, done. We added wreply. Good. And now on the STS. On the STS, things are mildly more interesting. Normally, the STS would, in the get scope, run this validate applies to that comes from default. And this just looks at the list of relying parties that are provisioned and see if the token is being asked for one of those. So that I can say, yes, you are my friend, here there's the token, or no, I don't know you, you won't get a token from me. Here, I'm adding this validate reply to, mainly for reminding the reader that we need to do something about this specific part. Because Otherwise, we have a security risk. In this case, I'm doing something very, very lame. I'm just looking if it's localhost or if it is hosted in Windows Azure, which of course means nothing, because somebody like a spammer may buy Windows Azure access and then come from this domain. So in your case, probably you would actually have a table of your values and actually make sure that those are the values to where you are sending stuff to. And then you'd just call this from get scope, in analogy to the other one. And here we have get scope, in which I added the entry reply to together with applies to. And here there is the interesting part. This is what, by default, is done by Windows Identity Foundation. My reply to address is the apply to address. In this case, it doesn't work. Like, for the applies to address, we need to use a logical address, not address, logical identifier, which tells me the identity of application. And instead, as a reply to address, I just see if I have a reply to. If I have it, I use it. Otherwise, I fall back on the default behavior. So, not hard. And it does work. So, not too bad. Okay. Certificates. This one is going to be subtle, but useful. What do you need the certificates for normally? You need both a certificate and private key if you want to expose an SSL endpoint. Then you need both. Or you want to decrypt stuff for yourself, then you need the private key. Or you are an STS and you are performing signatures, so you need it. You need just the certificate when you are checking signatures. You also need it when you want to encrypt for others, but details. Now, the mechanism that you have in Windows Azure, as I mentioned, is there is that common area which lives outside of your role, where you upload a PFX file. A PFX file is one format that is traditionally used for containing a private key and certificate. Now, the interesting part is that Windows Azure will accept only PFX files, even if you just need the certificate without the private key. And I haven't found a way with the tools, but again, I'm not an admin, so I may be just challenged, for creating a PFX without a private key. Luckily, in .NET, it's a couple of lines of code, and you do it. And in fact, we have various samples, but it's literally two lines. Thanks. And the configuration file is the one that says which of the certificates I have in my common area I want enabled, installed, deployed for my role in which stores. It all happens just in time. You can't add trusted routes. Okay, so how do I deal with all this stuff? If I need to do any of those three things, SSL, decryption, signature, I have to have the PFX. There is no way around it. So I love to upload it. Not that hard, there are APIs, there are samples, it's very straightforward, but you need it. For the signature of the STS, there is an interesting consideration. If the source of the token is a Microsoft product, our interpretation of the standard, and it's a legitimate interpretation, is to attach to the token also the bits of the X509 needed for checking that signature. In other words, if you don't care from where the certificate is coming from, you have all the mathematical needs for checking that the signature of a token is good. You don't need to have any certificate anywhere. So one trick you could use is you take the certificate of the identity provider that you trust. You make the thumbprint out of it, which is like the warp signature of the certificate. So that once you receive the bits of a certificate together with the token, you use those bits for checking your signature. Then you make the thumbprint of those bits. If it matches with the thumbprint that you have, perfect. That was one certificate of one identity provider that you recognize, and you didn't have to store the certificate in itself because it arrived together with the system. That's pretty nice and pretty handy. The side effect is that for being able to do that, you have to turn off the validation mode, because otherwise the system will try to look at it in the certificate store, and not finding it, it will be very upset. However, here the check is not about the validity of the certificate, it is about the identity provider. Like, we are not managing PKI here. We are managing trust relationships. You want to say something? The question is if this relaxes the issue of a trusted roots. If you just use it for those signatures, potentially yes, but still you'll use it somewhere else. Let's say that, for example, when you want to go and resolve the metadata, or when you establish the relationship and similar. So this is not the only place where you will ever meet these. Like, you need at some place to put in the trusted issuers list the thumbprint of that certificate, and that's the point in which you may have issues if you are not in a trusted one. Of course, that may not always be the case, because it is a perfectly valid WS security token not to attach the entire bits of a certificate in the message. And in fact, I may not be recalling it right, but I think that in WebSphere, few versions ago, like in 2004, they used a different strategy. And so there was the need to tweaking stuff here and there, because you are not forced to add the entire certificate. You can happily have a reference to the certificate that you used. At that point, this entire strategy fails, because you are not receiving the bits, you don't have it in the store, so what do? So in that case, you just create the keyless PFX, you upload it, and you live with that. At that point, this guy doesn't make any difference. Are you still with me so far? More or less. Okay. So let's talk about session. Typical session we make is made by cookies, right? Yes, we know it. And we use DP API for what we said before. So we encrypt using the machine key. However, if you have multiple instances, machine key may be different, so it may not work. So how do you deal with that in Windows Azure? You take the session security token handler, which is the one that decides how you serialize and deserialize the cookie, and you change the transforms. Instead of using the DP API, you use, for example, RSA. And you use as a base for RSA the certificate that you are using for SSL, since you already have it, and since it will be replicated already everywhere, because every endpoint needs to be able to do that. Not hard. You could use the machine key as well. Like, there are ways of having the machine key replicate across multiple machines. But personally, call me paranoid, I'm not crazy about something that is one cut and paste away from compromising. Like, one certificate is harder to move around, instead of a machine key potentially, like, so I feel safer if I use the RSA. Go ahead. Right. The remark is there is a distributed version of DP API. Yeah, I don't know if it's in Windows Azure. Like, Windows Azure with this virtualized environment may or may not using it. And so, let me actually show you in code how that works. And in the case of a passive case, this is like, I'm almost ashamed to show it. It's really, really, really trivial. Very, very trivial. So on the on service configuration created, finally we see another handler apart from a redirect from identity provider. Here I create a new list of cookie transforms. Let me format it for you before zooming in. Yes. So I have my usual deflate because I compress my cookie. And then I have my encryption cookie transform and my signature cookie transform. In both cases, I'm using from the configuration the certificate of the service in itself. So here, this code may never change. I just change the config and I change it before deploying. And then I just make service configuration, security token handlers, add or replace my own session handler, which of course sports this list of transformations. So very easy, very straightforward. Now, why am I both encrypting and signing? Okay. Because if I would just encrypt, which would be the temptation, then for encrypting, the certificate is available also to the client. So the client could just completely discard the cookie that I made and manufacture another cookie, putting godlike capabilities in it, and then re-encrypt it using my certificate. That would be a problem. But if I also sign, then fat chance it cannot do it. Because, of course, the signature can be done only by me. You encrypt with a public key, of course, always. Don't you love asymmetric cryptography?
That puts certain restrictions on the certificates you roll as well.
Of course, the capabilities that it does. So the case of WCF service. Our usual user, and here we know how it works. I come here, I get my token, back and forth, and then I spend my token here. So issues. Here we don't have the issues that we had before about the address. Like we have them, but we can work around them. Like we can make filters like address.any and similar, and just override it. Here the problem is again of a session, because here I may have multiple entries. And so we have to manage the session somehow. And we have also another problem, which is the metadata. Metadata which, if exposed by default, using the default mechanism, would use the physical address. So they would contain the port number. So big problem. Another thing we may think about is diagnostic. Like, if you work with WCF, you know that eventually you have to turn on tracing for trying to understand what is going on. And here, guess what? You don't have a file system. And so we needed to do some little trick for making sure that we save a trace in a place where we can see it. In fact, I went ahead of myself because here I had my nice animation, but I'm sure you guys imagined. So let's look quickly at one demo with WCF. Again, this is the end solution that you'll see in the labs with WCF. Web services. Let's see. Again, all this stuff works in 2010 just as well. I'm just showing 2008 because I've shown 2010 for the rest of the class. So here you can see again our usual makeup. cloud configuration, which contains a role which maps to a WCF service, usual localhost STS, and this time we have a client instead of having our browser. And here I can just hit F5, and we will have the usual effect, in which, as you can see down here, or probably you cannot see, but you have seen it before, it's just starting my simulation environment. So let's take a look at that. Simulation environment, it will eventually show up. I should have closed the virtual machine, which is eating resources right now. And here we are. Here there is our deployment. And this time, marvel, we have two of them. So we can actually start seeing some concurrency. So those are two instances of my WCF service. So let's take a quick look by launching a couple of clients. So here I'll start one instance. It's the usual weather client. Okay. So let me call one service. Another service. The service that I'm calling have a big sleep, thread sleep, so that I'm sure that when I call for the second time, I will find it busy, so I will be diverted to the second instance. And I should probably put a smaller part, but see. Let me zoom in. Here, for once, instead of avoiding to show the port, I actually used it for showing that it is actually talking to do different parts. Now we could play back and forth and see if we manage to swap them, but not hard. Okay. So let's go through the various problems and let's see how we solved. Well, no, we are way too far. So for the session, it's similar. The main difference are, one, putting WCF in cookie mode is hard. Let's say that normally WCF would create the session using a security context token, which follows its own WS star specification, like secure conversation and similar. And it's hard to like apply those mechanisms. But there is a way of putting it in cookie mode. Let's say that we actually send the session as a part of the headers. And at that point, we can use all the tricks that we were doing before. We still use the same technique. We write a security session security token handler, but in the rich client case, it is just harder to use the object model. So we do the same RSA transform, but for adding it in the web config, we need more classes and we need to end up with a behavior. And so that means that we have to write more code. Also, since we may hit on different nodes and we are actually listening there, we have to abstract away the node. So in the validator, we have to make sure that we clip that part of the address, otherwise the system will break. And so basically, those are the classes that I needed to put together for making sure that via configuration, I can assign this guy. And it's not hard. Let me show you the code. So, relying party. Here we have our RSA session token handler. You can see the list of transforms that are pretty much the same as before. I just have this set transform, and I put it in my constructor. And then in this validated token, we just have some code here. Let me see if this crawl works. Yes. In which in the endpoint, I just like abstract away details like the DNS way of expressing the part. I pull out the number, the port number, and similar. So that is absolutely straightforward. What's less straightforward is that I need all those classes. Like what we have just seen is this class, but for tying it in, we also need these and these. But like a syntactic sugar, like a no hard time in terms of concepts. But I don't know why it always ends in there. Yes. So, if you use the default mechanism in Windows Azure, the metadata that you produce will have the ports. We don't want that. So there is this mouthful KB971842, like easy to remember, which actually solves the issue. You install it and that's it. But you have to opt in. Like you cannot change the behavior out of the box because otherwise you may break others that rely on that specific behavior. So how do you do that? You add this little part in your web config in which you say, I want the request header for metadata address, and you opt in for the protocols and the ports where you want that to happen. Fine. Only thing you have to be very careful about is the ports that you use on the dev fabric are usually different from the ports that you use in the cloud, because in the dev fabric you also have the IIS, so those ports are blocked. In the cloud, not. So you have to remember to change those before delivering in the cloud, which, like, again, a chance of getting things wrong. I'm sorry, could you repeat? No, yes. So the question is, can I use a service name in here? This guy is a WCF thing, not a Windows Identity Foundation thing. So it lives in a completely different place. And unfortunately, WCF doesn't have the same mechanism as that one. So tracing. If you use WCF, you use tracing. As we said, WIF use the same mechanism. You can even use the same tool for watching traces. But if you cannot save on the file system or in the event stream, where do you save? You could write your own trace listener and dump stuff on the Azure storage. At that point, that's perfectly visible. However, there is one small detail, which is really very, very small, that is not for free. So you may want to be very careful in the way in which you you use it. Like, very careful is a bit of an exaggeration. Like, the charge for that is ridiculously small. And anyway, you don't keep the tracing on all the time. Otherwise, your speed would get to a crawl very fast. So, like, it is a non-issue. But for due diligence, you have to remind that. And then, like, connecting this trace listener to the storage is done in the on-start. In the lab, if you want to do that, is in there. And this one, I'm actually not going to touch. So, if you guys have... wait. Let me actually jump in here with a very quick summary. Remember that all we have done has been putting a big stone on the deck of cards. That doesn't change the rule of a game. Rules of a game are the same as before. It's simply a matter of how resources are handled in a network operating system as opposed to a local operating system. And there are a few things that you want to be careful of, which is how to handle endpoints, WReply versus multiple RP entries for the same RP, how to handle certificates, PFX versus checking signatures or similar, how to handle sessions, more or less how we have done it in passive and how we've done it in active. It's the same approach, just different syntactic sugar, and making sure that when you need to save something, you take into account where it goes. And so, wherever you are, on-premise or in the cloud, thank you, Windows Identity Foundation. All right, do you guys have questions? Yes, sir. So, and the question is?
Yeah, what's the benefit of deploying multiple instances of your app?
So, what's the benefit of deploying multiple instances of your app? Well, mainly performance. Okay. Like, you have a place where you put apps, and if you need more performance, like somebody puts a link to your website and you get crowd mobbed, you turn this knob and you add instances. But there are also other advantages, such as distribution. Like you can actually decide where to put this specific application. So there are certain rules in Europe for which certain data cannot leave the country. So at that point, when they deploy those applications, they choose which data centers they want it to. Or you could say, I don't care. You make it what's best for you, and then it just goes.
So Azure lets you say which data center.
Like there are geographic areas, and you can say where, more or less where you want it to execute. You have any questions? No questions.
It's not that you deploy it twice. You deploy it once, right? You just give back configuration. That's what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like there, at deployment time, among the various things that you specify, like, for example, the numbers of instances that you want, you can say to which data center you are bound or to which area you are bound. Anybody else?
Is there automatic deployment rules where you can set thresholds and stuff like that if the usage becomes so high and automatically deploy another instance, stuff like that?
So the question is about automatic rules for handling changing conditions in load. We should ask to my Windows Azure colleague counterpart, but as far as I know, not yet. Or no, like I don't know if they are in the plan or not, but as of now, like you are the one turning the knob. Also because the more instances you have, the more you pay. So, yes, sir.
As you deploy new packages of like next version of the same package, what happens to the previously connected user? So in terms of 24/7 availability, are the user going to see a downtime if we deploy a next version or?
So the question is, what happens when you deploy a new version? Are the users going to see a downtime? So here you have various tricks. Like you have one area, like the staging area, and the other is the production area. And when you put stuff in staging, you can still have stuff in production. And then there is actually a command which can swap the two things so that you can just click that button and the two things are already in the cloud. It just happens that they switch role. So in theory, there should be no downtime. Also, it would wait for one instance to go down before updating it and similar. So it should be transparently handled. Anybody else? Well, so thanks.